This episode of Timaqua Presents is supported by the National Young Composers Challenge, which supports and showcases the next generation of U.S. composers at their annual Composium. More information at youngcomposerschallenge.org. This is Timaqua Presents. I'm David McDonald. In this episode, I'm going to share with you a conversation I recorded between Matt Gorney and Carl Berger. Matt's organization, the Civic Minded Five, has been presenting creative music here in Orlando since long before I showed up in town. And I'll let him introduce you to Carl, but before I do that, I have a few favors to ask. First, share this podcast with a friend, even if they don't listen to podcasts. In fact, especially if they don't listen to podcasts. Seriously, this could be their first one. Just grab their phone, show them where the podcast app is, and go ahead and subscribe them to Timaqua Presents. Just do it for them. They'll thank you later, I promise. You'll probably get an awesome Christmas present this year. Second, rate and review us in the iTunes Store or Google Play directory. It takes just a few seconds, and it really helps new listeners to find us. Last, check out the upcoming events calendar at timaqua.com and pick out a concert. Any concert to come in and hear. Maybe even pick out more than one. Most of them are totally free. Just bring a bottle of wine or a snack to share. And while you're at the site or at the show, consider becoming a member. Members get all kinds of benefits, including preferred seating and discounts on ticketed events. Just go to timucua.com. That's T-I-M-U-C-U-A.com for more information. Now, let's get to that interview with Carl Berger. I can honestly say that Carl is one of the most fascinating people I've ever met. He's a musician, composer, educator, and more. He just performed this week at Timaqua with the Carl Berger Improvisers Orchestra, which is a thing you'll hear him talk about with Matt. And he sat down with the Civic Minded Five's Matt Gorney the next afternoon.
A piano student at the conservatory in the 50s. That's how long it's been. And I was destined to be a classical pianist, right? Until my teacher told me, from today on, you cannot do anything else. You have to play 8 hours of piano each day. And don't do anything else. That's what you do. And I said, I like playing music, but not necessarily everybody else's music all the time.
What was the patronage like in Germany if you were that accomplished player that played for 8 hours a day? What would be the career payoff or the financial payoff?
The career payoff that you would end up being one of a couple of thousand amazing playing pianists, of which only 100 get to actually play a lot.
And perform and tour. Yeah,
exactly. And the rest would be teaching piano.
Teaching piano for the rest of their lives and telling their students that they need to play 8 hours a day and pass that along.
Yeah, there you go.
So at some point, you start intersecting with the jazz musicians in Heidelberg. How did that come about?
Well, actually, when I was a student at high school, there was the American forces that came into Germany had started boy clubs, and in the boy clubs there were jam sessions, and when I was like 13, I would just go to those jam sessions already.
That young.
Yeah. And then at 14, 15, I would see concerts by American musicians who came to town because Heidelberg was the American headquarters in Europe. And all around, in about the 200-mile radius of Heidelberg, there were at least 10 military posts. Each one had army bands, Air Force bands, and some of the greatest jazz musicians right. played in those bands. And at, when I was 19, a club started in Heidelberg by the name of Cave 54, which was one of the first jazz clubs in Germany. And a lot of these musicians came to that club to jam. Among them, people like Lex Humphreys, Cedar Walton, Don Ellis, and Leo Wright. And I mean, it was like playing in New York, you know? And right. I was the house pianist then, you know, at
already
that club.
At that point.
Yeah.
And what year was that?
55, 56.
Oh, as early as 55.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, were the majority of the musicians playing at K-55 still currently members of the U.S. military?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, of course. They came, and one of the musicians was an MP, a military police, and he got the passes for everybody to even stay overnight. So they would like actually stay at the cave and sleep there and return in the morning. So there was like huge jam sessions of 7, 8, 10 players every night going on. Not everybody was great, you know, but some really great players were among them. Yeah.
Right. And who did you find your first musical symbiosis with from the American players?
Well, Cedar Walton was a pianist that was pretty accomplished then already. So I looked at what he did and tried to play like him, you know.
Was he aware of that?
No, not really.
Kind of the Sam Rivers told the story of Earl Hines playing in a club, and whenever Duke Ellington would walk in, Earl would take his hands off the piano keyboard because he just knew it would become part of a Duke Ellington composition down the road
right.
otherwise. So Cedar wasn't aware of that you were becoming a young version of him.
Right. But then, you know, I told my conservatory teacher, he asked me about jazz all the time. And I kept saying to him, well, I'm paying you. So why do you ask me questions? Why didn't you come to the club?
You were getting the real life experience.
And I told him, why didn't you come to? And he said, well, I'm a professor at the conservatory. I cannot afford to be seen there. But then he showed up with like sunglasses and a hat and a coat and had sat in a corner, hopefully not to be. So nobody would like recognize him. It got really stupid, you know. And then I said to him, listen, if you can't come to our club, I can't come to the conservatory anymore. So
you had
that
was
the end of my classical career. I was also studying at the university at that time already. I was interested in philosophy and sociology and musical history and stuff like that. So I was and then later in Berlin at the university there.
And did you think that would be your career?
Yeah,
as
I was
educator.
I wasn't sure. I was actually a writer. I was writing for the newspaper. I was like writing about philosophy and about basketball and about all kinds of things. And I wasn't sure what I should be writing or playing as a profession.
You were fascinated with basketball.
No, they just asked me to write, you know.
So you wrote it as some sort of existential thing from outside the bubble.
No, I played basketball.
You did play basketball.
Yeah, yeah. Also, the teacher told me I should not do that because it's very bad for your fingers.
Your fingers, yeah. I mean, one bad jam on you.
Oh, yeah.
On your fingers.
You're finished,
of your career. Right. So after being in Heidelberg and in Berlin, what would be your next significant experience as a jazz musician?
Well, the most significant was that a guy by the name of Hans Koller called me. Hans Koller was at the time the leading saxophone player in Europe. And he called me, and I never knew why he chose me to be his piano player. And I played in the Hans Koller Quartet, and that threw me on the European scene. I'd mm-hmm. be opened for Miles and Mingus and for all these bands that came to town. We would be the opening act, or we played at festivals, and I got into different European countries that way. We got to Paris, and so out of a sudden, this whole world opened up from a $20 a day piano player at the Cove.
Right. Right.
It was out of a sudden one of the leading European piano players, and I didn't know how that happened.
You know? Didn't it just happened, and you just went along with it?
Yeah, I went along with it, and it was easy because Hans didn't have a big repertoire. He played the same tunes over and over, you know, so I just had to really learn those.
Later, he would become quite a big band composer and arranger. That was not happening at that point?
No, not at all.
So you didn't learn larger arrangement from him?
No, I never studied arrangement either. No, I never studied these things. I didn't. There was no school for that anyway. You know, now you have all these schools where you learn jazz and or what they call jazz, at least. And you learn all these systems of how to write and so on, but that didn't exist at that time, you know.
So this is probably a good point to talk about meeting Don Cherry.
Yeah.
Because there is no formal system.
No. Yeah, you have to see, like, from our vantage point now, you cannot even imagine what the scene was like at the time. Because at the time when you played, when you were a player and you were on the scene, you played every day. Maybe except for Mondays, maybe. So you played like 6 days a week at least, live in clubs. Clubs were not one-nighters. They were like 1 month.
A job.
Or 3 months.
A contract. You had a contract.
Yeah, you were in there, you know, and so it was a whole other thing. You know, this is how you learn to play. Like, that was the school, you know. And so Hans Koller took us to Paris. And in Paris, we met a bunch of people. And I also found this vibraphone that you heard last night. I got that in 61 in Paris. From a vibraphone player who played with us, with the quartet as a soloist. We were on tour with him. And I kind of liked the vibraphone for a dumb reason. At the club in Heidelberg, the piano was always out of tune and bad. And the club didn't have money to tune it all the time. And there was a vibraphone player who left his instrument there all the time for days without anybody playing it. So I started playing it, you know. And I liked the idea that you could get up and you could dance and move. But I purposely decided I'm not going to study that.
Had you seen a great vibraphone player before learning to play vibraphone?
A scene live?
Yes.
Yeah, actually I did. There was a Danish player who played with the American players, but it was not an American player. And it was really fascinating, just the sound of it. I really liked the sound. But, you know, actually the way vibraphone is being taught and played, I don't really care for much. I don't really, most vibraphone to me sounds like doorbells. The reason is very simple. You just have to think about metal. Metal is like has the highest overtone range of anything. This is why the churches always have bells to call people from far away. You know, if you live 5 miles away, you can hear the church bell, right? But you hear it because it's one gong, bong, and then there's another one. You don't hear like four bells ringing at the same time. Because if you play the four notes at the same time, what happens is you cancel out most of the overtones. And it becomes like a dull sound in my ears.
You've never played with four mallets.
I never liked it.
Yeah.
I tried a little bit of it, but it doesn't interest me.
Your vibraphone playing is very distinct.
Yeah.
And exactly. Now seeing your vibraphone all these years later and realizing it's that same vibraphone.
Yes.
It is between your playing and this Turkish vibraphone that you have.
Yeah.
It's such a distinct sound, and nobody sounds like you.
I never studied it. I started to play different from other people, and for that reason, as soon as I joined Don's band, I ended up in the Downbeat Pulse. Till today, every Downbeat Pulse, I'm in there because nobody plays like that.
Right.
You know?
So you met Don Cherry, this was in a nightclub?
No, yeah. What happened was we started to play a lot. I had married Ingrid. And Ingrid is a singer, and we worked together quite a bit. And we used to drive to Paris to play there, because there was not that much happening in Germany, really. The jazz scene was in Paris at the time. That was sort of where everybody met.
Expatriates.
And also a lot of American musicians were there. And there were a lot of clubs. There were like 10 different clubs happening every night. So we always went there to play in those clubs. We played with Chet Baker. We played with Woody Shaw, Nathan Davis, all these people that were there, you know, Art Taylor, Johnny Griffin, everybody, you know. So it was like another level of playing that you could not find in Germany. And one night we went into the Buttercup Club, that's what it is. Buttercup Club was a club run by Bud Powell's wife. But it wasn't like a live music club. It was sort of more like a cafe. And a few weeks or months before, we had for the first time heard This Is Our Music by Ornette. That album, you might know what I'm talking about.
Right.
And it has like a photo of the four players.
Just a great color portrait of the quartet.
Exactly. And we listened to that music, and both Ingrid and myself said, that's the music we want to play. Because it was free, but it was there was rhythm. And there was already a lot of free music in Europe. But it was more oriented towards the classical new music. It was staying away from rhythm or from beats. You know, it was not beat oriented. And we liked the beats, but we wanted to be free. That was it. It was right there. I said, well, this is exactly how I want to play. So in Paris, when I saw Don Cherry, I said, that's Don Cherry. Because it's how could not?
So distinctive looking. Sure.
And I did something I've never done in my life then or since. I just walked up to Don and I said, Don, my name is Carl Berger and I want to play with you. I mean, just like that. And Don is a very intuitive person. He looked at me and he said, the rehearsal is tomorrow at 6:30 or 4:30 or whatever it was. And from that day, the next day, for the next 3 years, I played every day with Don Cherry.
Thank you.
And the funny thing about that band was we couldn't talk together, because Gatto only spoke Spanish. Aldo only spoke Italian and French. And I spoke only German and English. And Jenny Clark spoke French and English. And Don only spoke English.
Right.
So there was no common language.
Right.
So there was never any discussion. It was just okay, hello, play.
Right. How much had Don's music changed since the recordings you
heard? We played some of those tunes, you know. We learned at least 30, 40 of the tunes that he played with Ornette. But he was the first musician ever to pick up world music, world musical themes. And the way he did it was he walked around with a shortwave radio, earphones, all day long he had those on. And he had what Ornette called elephant memory, which is he could like hear melodies just once and know it, you know?
So this preceded him becoming that sort of itinerant world traveler that he later became. The shortwave radio was the...
Exactly. He picked up all this music, and every day in the rehearsals, he would come in the rehearsal. The rehearsals were at 4:30. He would come in, say hello, and pound it on the piano out the melody he had just heard on the shortwave radio, which he didn't know where it was from. And he would expect us to have the same elephant memory. He wanted us, that same night, he wanted us to play that with him, you know.
Right.
So it was a constant tiptoe kind of thing, trying to follow, keep up with Don.
Right. And how much influence did this have on the creation of the Creative Music Foundation?
Oh, huge, because that's where I learned a few things that I'm still telling people today. First of all, Don, the first thing Don told me, there's no A. Don't play, don't think of a note, think of sound. There's always sound, there's always harmony. You never play a single note, there's no single note. There's always harmony. If you play your A, you have to have another note in mind in order to really play it well, no matter whether that's on the piano or on the trumpet or wherever. Yeah, that was huge for me, you know? And the other one was the world musical aspect, the fact that you could just, like people could play together no matter what tradition they came from. So that brought out in me the idea that we could study music not thinking about style. So not having a conservatory of classical music and a jazz department and Indian music and Turkish music, but we could have a school or maybe an experimental place where we ask what's common to all the music. So there's like rhythm and there's sound. So you learn what kind of exercises or practices we could develop to work in this, what I call ground floor of music study. You know, and so we came up with the gamelataki sessions. We came up with overtone singing and practices like that. And then come up with the harmonic tuning that we do with the improvised orchestra and so on. You know, so basically these principles developed out of the work with Don.
So the Creative Music Foundation starts in 1971.
Yeah.
And these were all the initial goals from the outset.
Yeah.
Did anything change from your initial goals to what it developed into? Were there surprises or were there left turns or right turns away from the original goal?
You know, we're still doing the same stuff. It's just a lot more musicians involved.
It sounds like you hit the bullseye.
Yeah. And
in
also
1971.
Yeah. And also what happened was that so many musicians were like really tuning into that idea. You know, not having to think of jazz or think of classical, think of Brazilian music, think of African, but like just play together,
right?
You know, and develop that. So musicians got drawn to the place, and it was like a very fast development. I started it with Ornette. Like through Don, we met Ornette. As soon as we came to New York, which was in '66, we came to record a Symphony for Improvisers album, a Blue Note album.
Right.
Yeah, and then I went back actually to Europe for a little while in AS 68, 69, then came back and I met Carla Bley, who told me about the nonprofit way, because she had started a nonprofit organization. And she told me, why don't you do that? Go the nonprofit way, raise funds, and develop that. So I talked to Ornette about that and said, Ornette, would you do that with us? You know, we'll start it together.
Right.
Ornette had a typical answer. He said, yeah, I'll do that, but as long as you do the nonprofit, I do the profit.
Ornette always had in the mind on the money.
Yeah, exactly.
A revolutionary with the mind on the money as well.
You do the nonprofit, I do the profit.
Do the profit. So to talk briefly about the improvisers' orchestras that we have seen, I have a few observations.
Yeah.
And I noticed in the workshops both time you don't use adjectives that relate to musical genres.
Yeah, like what?
Using the term jazz or classical or descriptive terms from those genres.
Yeah.
That is strictly avoided, or is it just something that you've naturally?
It doesn't say anything. The words jazz, classical are empty words. They mean, like, if I mention the word jazz to in a room of 20 people, each of these 20 people will hear different music in their heads. Right? Jazz could be anything, right? It could be New Orleans. It could be Peter Brassman or whatever, you know? I mean, there's no boundary, actually. So the word jazz has become meaningless, really. Classical, the same thing. You know, is it John Cage or is it Bach?
Right.
You know?
It seems like you have to start with textual and verbal directions, but you move away from that quite quickly.
Yeah. Exactly.
And I've noticed that during the concerts, you're never giving directions to the musicians with words.
Yeah.
But also, it seems like you've also gotten away from even verbal direction of any sort. Mm. You know, if you think about, say, James Brown led a band, and they move from section to section of the forum a lot based on his verbal directions, whether they were textual verbal directions or just him making a sound like an instrument.
Yeah.
A mutual friend of ours, Sam Rivers, did it without words, but did it dynamically and rhythmically, where he gave a lot of directions away from dynamics. And I've noticed once you've moved through the workshop into the concert with these musicians, it is all hand signals.
Yeah.
Okay. It's all done with signal and body gesture.
Yeah.
And your whole body.
Right.
Purposeful based on the difference between gesture and verbal or textual language. So by the time you go from the workshop and move into the actual concert, I didn't hear you really speak to the musicians or even give any sort of audible direction. It has all become body movement and hand gestures.
All right. Well, there are two answers. First of all, while we do the rehearsals, I get to hear a little bit what everybody does. And between the workshop and the concert, I've talked in this particular time, I talked to about 10 of the musicians between the workshop and I gave them the freedom to do what they needed to do by just telling them, I really want to hear you develop your ideas, okay? At the same time, I told them, don't hesitate waiting for signals to come in with this or that or the other thing. In other words, to create a certain sense of openness, you know, for people to get active, to be active and feel free and not to, because it's kind of hard with just one rehearsal to relate to people that that I'm really open to hear something that I don't expect and then to react to that and work with that. Because that's what it should be, you know. Like the New Yorker Orchestra, which now had 85 performances, is like much more independent of me, you know, what they do and how they initiate things than, let's say, a situation like this, you know. And that's what I like. I like it to be, that's why it's not called an improvisation orchestra, it's called an improvisers orchestra. They're all individuals, you know, each one is an individual and should like really cut through with their ideas, you know, and their feelings, you know.
Improviser, it should have a possessive improvisers in the title. They have ownership stake in your concept.
Yeah.
I have a question to wrap up. Coming from the executive director of Tsimikwa Arts Foundation, Chris Mell. Okay. And last night after the concert, he looked at me and he said, Jeff Buckley's grace?
Yeah.
Question mark.
Yeah.
So briefly, could you tell the story how that you became involved in Jeff Buckley's Grace album?
Well, that's maybe too long a story to tell. You know, because early on, Bill Laswell used to come to the Creative Music Studio, and he started some of his career there by starting the Curlew Band at CMS. That's really a CMS band. And then I talked to Bill a few years later when he started to be a producer for mostly avant-garde funk and reggae and bands like that. I said, listen, I'm listening to your records, and maybe you should use strings instead of horns sometimes, you know, because it's sort of better with the guitars to me than the horn sections, you know. The horn sections are good for the kind of funk thing, but for the reggae stuff and the more going more in that direction where the bass, where the bass is busier and everything is a little more, the textures are like more fluid. Why don't you? We write strings, but we write them like horns, but we're using strings. So he said, "Oh yeah, let's do that." And we made about 50 records like that. I wrote for him, and some of them were two or three of them ended up. A lot of them ended up on Island Records. But I got also somehow connect Ayat through, he then brought in Buckethead, and that was a Sony project.
Okay.
All right? And so Buckethead, I met Buckethead, and he wanted strings for his songs, which were like TV songs, because Buckethead had grown up not going to school, but sitting in front of a TV playing guitar, imitating the songs that came from the TV. And that was his songs, you know. His songs ended up sounding just like the TV. And then he wrote a couple of songs where he wanted strings for. And for some reason, Laswell got involved in that. And Laswell called me, you know, and he got me together with Buckethead, and we struck it really quickly, you know. It was very easy work for me. I just wrote these strings for him. And then Sony called me for the Jeff Buckley thing, you know. So I ended up on a Sony roster of arrangers. And Jeff was in Woodstock. His father lived in Woodstock. He was dead already at that time.
Right.
But he was familiar with Woodstock, and the recording was in Woodstock, you know, at the Bearsville Theater, Bearsville Records. And I met Jeff, and immediately I said, yeah, I want to do that. Because Jeff, like, I could talk to him about Shostakovich or Bill Evans or anybody. He knew all of the music. He was an unbelievable guy, you know, in terms of musicality. And I said, and it was also the first guy that I met in that genre who didn't give me any references. He just said, you write what you want. And I just wrote stuff that then later got copied for album after album. I've heard that stuff again.
You've heard your work.
Yeah, right.
Echoing
it just came
on
right
other
back.
Records. So that record has become such a reference.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, like a song like Last Goodbye, there was never such an arrangement of running right along the song. And I had written much more. They actually scratched half of the arrangements. I wrote like, I heard his voice and I heard cello running along that voice. And I wrote that and they scratched that. It was so bad. They said, well, it's a solo album, you know. His first solo album. You don't want to have another soloist next to it, you know.
That
was really fun to write that.
Yeah.
So and the reason why this happens, you know, like if you think in terms of style, it will never happen. But if you think in terms of sound and rhythm, you can go anywhere in the music. And you can put quality into any of these things. You know, like to me, I'm very happy I did that because a lot of people got to hear that. But there's some of my music in there. Like, what, you know, nobody else would write like that, you know. So it's a real opportunity without my name being really in the forefront at all. Is a real opportunity to write for a larger group of people. And there's a lot of people who know me because of this, which is nice. It helps me with my other work, you know. But it's not like some people said, oh, you're doing commercial work. To me, that was not commercial work. This was music.
It was music. You know?
Yeah.
It's all music.
Totally, because there was no, I wasn't sitting there, oh, I shouldn't do that because of this and that. But we were making music, you know. But if you like think of yourself as a jazz musician or this, that, and that kind, you will never do that. It's like sort of, oh, now this is like out of my, but you know, but it's to me, it's like important to not ever exclude anything like that. I did exclude things like, you know, Britney Spears called me, the manager of Britney Spears. He wanted me to write. And they had exactly in mind what they wanted to hear. And this was probably a lot more money. And I told them, you called the wrong guy. I'm not writing what you know you want to hear. I write what I write, you know. And if you like it, you like it. If you don't, you don't. Yeah. He never called me again. So that stuff happens. It's not that I would just like do anything like you know, that kind of work.
Yeah. My industry work. Carl Berger, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks again to Carl Berger and Matt Gorney for that conversation. Subscribe to this feed for an extended performance by Carl, Ingrid, and the Improvisers Orchestra in the near future. And I wanted to let Matt make a nice quick plug for a great show he's got coming up with Civic Minded 5, also at Timucua.
A legend of electronic music, Hans Joachim Rodelius of Cluster and Harmonia fame. And also collaborations with Brian Eno in the 1970s. That concert is Wednesday, March the 27th. Tickets are available at timucua.com.
This show is made possible through the support of the National Young Composers Challenge. National Young Composers Challenge helps to promote and encourage composers of the future. U.S. composers aged 13 to 18 are eligible to enter compositions for orchestra and chamber ensemble. Winners have their works performed and recorded at a fantastic event here in Orlando each November called the Composium. And seriously, if you can make it to this, if you are in or within a reasonable driving distance of Orlando, Florida this November, you have got to check this thing out. I've never seen anything like it. readings by amazing professional performers, conversations with the composers, and these are really young composers, so they have really interesting thoughts, feedback from judges, feedback from the audience. Again, you'll never see anything like this. I've never even heard of anything like this anywhere else. You just have to check it out. Visit youngcomposerschallenge.org for more information about submitting and the Composium event itself. We thank them for supporting the Timpical Arts Foundation, and if you would like to join them by supporting future episodes of this podcast, please just get in touch with us at podcast@timpical.com. The executive producer of Timpical Presents is Chris Belt. It was recorded and edited by me, David McDonald. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you at the show.